Hi and welcome to the podcast. You're having tea with Alice. This week's episode is a solo question and answer podcast, which I'm getting to slightly late on Thursday because I just came back from a celebration dinner with my brother and my dad to celebrate my twin brother getting his PhD, which was lovely. And it just meant that I was out slightly later than I had intended to be. And so I'm getting on to this, putting this podcast up a little bit slow. So I put out a question a call for questions that people want to ask me, and I got a huge number of responses. I might have to split this up, maybe put some up for Patreon subscribers, but I will put up this first section now at least, because you guys asked some incredibly interesting questions and I hope to provide some at least competent answers, or maybe interesting answers. And if I don't have an answer for something, I'm not going to try to pontificate. I don't think everyone has to have an opinion on everything, so I will... sorry, if there is noise, it's because it's boiling hot in London, so I've left my windows open, so buses might drive past in the background. It shouldn't be too interrupty. It's not a busy tea shop or anything like that. So let us begin. So question and answers, tea with Alice. I am sitting here, I'm having a cup of lemongrass tea because it's late at night and I don't want to whack my system with caffeine. And if you don't know what this is an a. If you haven't heard the podcast before, you haven't listened, this is an atypical episode. I tend to do difficult conversations with interesting people, and I aim to just talk about complicated things in nuanced ways. Nuance is such an overused word now, both underused and overused, but you know what I mean. Trying to have conversations where you don't know necessarily where you're coming from or where you're going to, but like a proper legit conversation, not just a party line versus a party line. But that's what I normally do. This week is a question and answer tea with Alice, sitting here with my lemongrass tea in my bedroom late at night on a very hot heatwave London night. First question, Quinton on Twitter. These are mostly going to be Twitter ones, and then I'll get to the other ones maybe in the next episode. But Quinton asks, what advice do you have for people who want to get humans to talk compassionately to each other in spite of not seeing eye to eye on certain things? Differences of opinion are so normal and human, but they can seem so intractable nowadays, even if they are really small or subtle. It's a good question, Quinton. Look, I don't know. I think remembering that the person you're talking to is a person, I think that gets lost a lot of the time because it's so fundamental, I think, to people nowadays on both sides of the political divide to think of other people as being stupid rather than wrong, or malicious rather than wrong, or naive rather than wrong. I think being wrong is not such a bad thing. I think you need to see people's minds as being more flexible. Even if people have inflexible minds, where their opinion comes from, it's not endemic to their character. It's something that is informed by their circumstances, by the information, by the that is available to them, by the people around them, by the conversations that they have. So, seeing that opinion as what it is, an opinion rather than an excrescence of their character, some sort of horn that is grown on them because that's who they are, is important, and it makes a conversation much less loaded because you're not arguing against somebody's selfhood, although people seem to want to define their selfhood by the opinions that they hold now, and you know, particularly on the left, that you should have these opinions if you are a compassionate person, and if you don't have these opinions then you're not a compassionate person. I think that kind of rhetoric is so appealing and also dangerous. Rather than thinking of somebody's opinion as an outgrowth of their character, it's useful, at least if what you want to do is talk to people as humans, it's useful to think of their opinion as being formed by information and by various other pressures, but not necessarily as an outgrowth of their character. I don't know whether that extends to... I mean, obviously there are opinions that are so sort of abhorrent that it's difficult to think of them as anything other than evil, or that you could maintain them in the face of the evidence in front of you. It seems sort of appalling. So I'm not sure how far that goes, but certainly just as a starting principle for talking to somebody with whom you disagree even vehemently, I think it's a useful way to approach a conversation. So thank you, Quinton. Next question. James asks, what is a rape joke? I'm not being an asshole, but I've seen the squabbles that have happened. However, I cannot imagine a dimension in which rape would be the punchline of a joke. So it depends what you mean by a rape joke. It's sort of a term that can mean a number of things, but let's say a joke that is about rape. It depends when you say, rape isn't necessarily the punchline. The target of the joke can be the rapist, in which case, why would you not be okay with making fun of rapists? If your problem is bringing up the idea of rape in the minds of people who might be vulnerable to that, then I think that's a difficult question, because I think you should be allowed to talk about even really unpleasant ideas, and you should be able to think about them. Obviously, some people can't. Some people are vulnerable, in which case they should, if they can, be as careful as possible about the kind of things that they expose themselves to if they're vulnerable in that way. And if a comedian offends or hurts that person, then you can have a conversation one-to-one about it. I would say don't save it to tweet about afterwards. A rape joke that is traditionally less acceptable, where the punchline is, the 90s lad culture, where people would say stuff to be shocking deliberately, and open mic rooms where the punchline is, oh, and then I raped her. That stuff is very out of favour now among comedians and audiences. It's not really acceptable because it's just sort of taboo breaking for the purpose of taboo breaking. But usually, I would imagine that kind of joke is deployed in an ironic way. The joke is that this person would never do that and would never say that, and you as an audience with a connection to the performer should know that. But that sort of trivialising the severity of the thing, turning it into a punchline, that is the kind of joke when people say rape jokes are unacceptable. That's the kind of joke they usually mean. And I mean, it's in the news very much at the moment with the firing of James Gunn, who was the director of Guardians of the Galaxy, because of some really horrendous jokes that he made years and years ago. And if you think about the period in which he made those jokes, that's the kind of, again, South Park, Sarah Silverman, this kind of saying outrageous things for the sake of saying outrageous things. I think of it as the discourse equivalent of cliff diving. There's a lot of machismo in it. There's a lot of, oh, I don't give a fuck, or I can say whatever I want. You have Ren and Stimpy, that sort of embrace of the grotesque for the purpose of causing shock and awe and admiration for somebody's moxie or somebody's outrageousness. That kind of joke has also very much fallen out of favour. Although I've seen it done in sort of more clowning abstract ways, if that makes sense. I've seen people miming a rape joke, if that makes sense, and that doesn't seem to have come under such scrutiny, mainly because it's not on Twitter as much. But I hope that answers your question. So, to sum up, when you say a rape joke, whether it's acceptable or not, or whether it's acceptable to me, I mean, from my personal kind of sense of it, in part, it depends on the target, the structure of the joke, the persona of the joke teller, and whether the joke is just for the fun of saying something awful, or whether and taboo breaking in that way. Which, if it's not directed, if it's not hate speech or an incitement to violence, then I think it's gross, it's distasteful. I don't know if it should be illegal, but certainly I wouldn't be surprised if very few audiences would laugh at that nowadays. So it's sort of no longer on the cards for most comedians. Again, I sort of tried to sum that up and got sidetracked into a ramble, but this is what happens when you're talking to a wall. So question and answer number three. Do you feel a sense of belonging to a place when you're travelling? Do you miss a home as such, or is the world your home? So I don't... I miss people. I miss experiences. There are places in Sydney that I miss. There are places in Melbourne that I miss. But it's more... It's more the comfort of knowing where you're... Knowing where your stuff is. I don't really have stuff. It's being able to know I can walk out and go for a swim in the harbour at Red Leaf in Double Bay and see the mural with my mum's face on it and go along the cliffs in Diamond Bay and look out at the ocean. Those are the things that I think feel like home to me. Those experiences are not the whole of home, and they're so broadly scattered. There are things in London that feel like home, and wherever you are, you sort of build up that sense of comfort. Is that an answer? Maybe it's an answer. There's a bunch of bugle questions, which I don't think I should answer on Tea with Alice. It feels improper to be talking about puns and flamingos on this thing. Maybe I need to separate my brands or have a different identity. But Lewis Dunn, let's move on from the cascade of flamingo questions and pun questions. Lewis Dunn asks, have you ever written / witnessed a joke you knew to be immoral but still found very funny? How do you feel about immorality in comedy? Well, I was brought up very strictly in a kind of a Buddhist tradition where wrong speech is a thing. So that sort of swearing might fall into that. So maybe when I swear, I do feel a little immoral, if that makes sense. But slander and harsh speech and lies and so on and so forth, I was brought up to think of them as immoral, and there's still part of me that probably thinks of them as immoral. I think what would constitute immorality in a joke, a breach of confidence if you're telling somebody story who is not, it's that you've promised them to keep it a secret, or it's really obvious that it's not meant to be shared. Stealing a joke would count as immoral. Passing off somebody else's joke as your own. Incitement to violence is not immoral, it's illegal. It's both immoral and illegal, but it's more importantly illegal. All jokes are rhetoric. All speech is rhetoric, particularly comedy shows can be rhetoric. So if you're telling a story in a way that is shaped to cause harm, I would think of that as immoral. Is there something that is immoral that I would also find very funny? Probably yes. Probably almost certainly yes. There are, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but I remember in my teens with my brother's friends laughing about, again, those kind of outrageous things that people would say that were probably not right to say. How do I feel about immorality in comedy? Oh, man. I don't know. Lying about somebody in a funny way, I think, would count as immoral, and I would probably laugh at that and then feel bad if I found out later that it was a lie. Or even maybe if I knew at the time that it was a lie, but it was well-structured as a joke. Sometimes it's just the structure of a joke. I hope that's an answer. VB asks, who are you and what are you drinking? I am Alice Fraser. I'm drinking lemongrass tea. Uncle Yo asks, one of your earliest jokes? What is one of my earliest jokes? Relevant maybe to the James Gunn thing. I used to have a joke about a pedometer. I just got a pedometer the other, and it was just a very, it's like a pun, but probably not acceptable nowadays, I would say. I bought a pedometer the other day. Apparently I've passed 2,365 pedophiles today. It's more than you'd think. They hide themselves well, usually in positions of power. I think that was the joke. And it was basically just a wordplay, but probably wouldn't be acceptable nowadays on stage. I'm not sure. I think, you know, just, well, who knows? These days, the lines shift very quickly. I probably wouldn't tell that joke now. I don't know if I would get away with that joke now, but I probably wouldn't tell it. If only because it's an old joke. John asks, as an artist or creative person, do you ever experience periods of time when you're unmotivated to create? Yes. Yes, John, I do. And further, is there an artistic experience that pulls you out of it that you can call on every time? No, there is not. It's different every time. Usually a deadline will do it. I'll turn something out for a deadline. Tony Cross asks, is there any hope? Tony, that is subjective. I don't know. Yes, why not? There's hope in terrible places. If you mean generally for the world, there will be good things, there will be bad things. There are places in the world now where the apocalypse has already happened, you know? And there are places in the world that for a long time will remain luxurious bubbles. And if you fall somewhere between those things, then there's hope of going further up towards the joy of freedom and enough to eat. And if you're down the bottom, then there's probably the sight of those further up the slider to motivate you. In terms of brain chemistry, I don't know about your personal circumstances. I hope there is hope. I have hope for you. Dan asks, a lot of the scripted shows being taken to Edinburgh this year will never be recorded, which feels like a massive shame. I believe almost all of your shows have been recorded, and I'm interested in why you have chosen to do so and your thoughts on the other shows that aren't slash can't. I record things because I there are people who want to see them or hear them that can't get to Edinburgh or Sydney or Melbourne. If I've worked on something for a year, I'd like people to see it if they want to. So making that possible for me to do is modern technology, the fact that I can just slap my recorder down on the stage at least and get an audio of every show. I started doing it because I had a friend who'd been really badly heckled by somebody who then complained about her to the venue, and she had an audio recording of the whole show, and I thought that's a good idea. So I do record actually most shows that I do, even of the same show. Hundreds and hundreds of audio files floating around on my phone somewhere, which I probably need to clean up. But that means I have a record of the good shows and the bad shows, and at some point I will listen to even one of those. I never do. But they're there, which means something. Simon asks, what are your thoughts on the yes means yes law, which has recently been introduced in Spain? You are my touchstone for these types of issues, and I'd be really interested to know your take. I mean, Simon, that is a massive compliment. I don't know if I should be anyone's touchstone for any issue. I'm very uncertain about most things, and many of the things I say are placeholders for me wanting to think about something more. Yes means yes law, recently introduced in Spain. I don't actually know enough about this law. I assume that if it is what it sounds like it is, the yes means yes, that you need to say yes, give positive consent to constitute consent legally, and that anything below that would constitute rape. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. I think if it became a social norm, that would be a positive thing. I think legislating it, I mean, is it for, do you have a, what do they call, implied consent in a relationship where you can make the moves on a partner, long-term partner, and assume that they'll be open to it? I think seeking positive consent is a good thing to do. I also think that I don't know how you would enforce that. I mean, any more than you enforce current sexual assault and rape laws, that she would say she had not said yes, he would say she had said yes, in the way that with current sexual assault and rape cases, he says, well, she was consenting, she gave me no indication that she wasn't consenting. Like, it would fall down to the same kind of word, one person's word against another. There is less room, maybe, for the ambiguities where somebody would not say no and be, from a reasonable man's perspective or a drunken man's perspective, perceived to be consenting when internally she was not consenting. I think that's a really awful situation in the law for both parties, worse for the lady, but certainly for a generally well-meaning guy who is not good at reading social signals, That's a circumstance that can arise and has arisen without malice, which is a terrible, terrible thing. That would be less likely to happen if he has to seek positive consent. But equally, I don't think it erases the possibility of coercively extracted positive consent, where there's something on the line, or where he's being very pushy, or where she says yes, even though she's uncomfortable, because she feels unsafe. All of those things would still be present. So that is an unclear answer to your very clear question. I'm sorry, I didn't do the research into this law, but those are the things that phrase, the yes means yes law, brought up in my mind. I think that's an answer of a sort. Jeff says, my birthday is today, I turned 54. Happy birthday for about a week ago, Jeff. As I straddle the pre-tech and tech world in glorious middle age, what are your thoughts on how we record, retain, and teach history now? Oof, Jeff. Listen to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. That is a great history podcast. We have so much now that it's almost become useless. There's so much data available that history, which I guess was always a process of curation, has become more explicitly so. And nowadays you have so much conflicting information, even to the point where people have become postmodern about scientific facts. I've heard more and more and more people dismissing studies and science by saying that, or because we have a greater understanding now of how much the outcomes of science are driven by funding and bias and so on and so forth, that there's this real mistrust now of expertise and facts and scientific studies. It is a problem, basically. I think maybe what your question was, is this a problem? We are in an age now where everyone is their own personal historian, but we don't have the kind of filters and gateways and standards and citation requirements that would have existed previously, or maybe in an ideal world would exist. I don't know how we're going to solve that as a people unless we put our own feelings aside when it comes to assessing facts. And with all of the negative side impacts, or negative impacts, main impacts, depending on how you place them, of the project of empiricism being sort of tied in with imperialism, the Enlightenment project being tied in with colonialism in people's minds, and the fury and righteous anger that is backlashing against that whole movement. I don't know what's going to happen. I like the idea that facts are facts, and that you can determine facts even if you don't want to, that there can be something that is so undeniably true that you can't deny it, even if it makes you feel bad or sad or annoyed or hurt. I like that idea because I want to believe that that facts are facts, and that sometimes would mean having to digest unpalatable facts. But nowadays, I don't think we can necessarily trust many facts. I don't know how we're going to move away from where we are now towards a place where we can agree on how you would assess truth. At the moment, feelings are more important than truth for both sides of politics and for the people in the middle. I've heard people say, well, I don't believe this about the same fact, about whatever it happens to be. I don't believe this study because, of course, these scientists are just trying to please blah, or of course you can't trust the liberal establishment of lefties in universities, or this scientist is a racist, or whatever it happens to be. If you can't trust the people doing the science, how can you trust that? Maybe it's getting science done by AIs. Maybe that's what we need to do, getting robots to do science. But then whoever's programming the robots might have brought some biases in. Those are my thoughts. Anyway, no clear answers in this podcast, Jeff. But thank you for the question, and happy birthday again. Lucia asks, or says, Says and then asks. She says, you don't talk about your sexuality or sexual relationships on stage. Is that a deliberate choice? Yes, it is a deliberate choice. It's for a couple of reasons. One is I would like to protect the people in my life. And second is that I think creative constraint is a good way to do something interesting. So I like something, I like structure, I like deadlines. Working within limitations, for me at least, is more useful than being an amoebic blob trying to find myself in a world of possibilities. There's so many possibilities. I can say anything I want on stage if I'm willing to take the consequences, and that can be incredibly overwhelming. If I take out a whole chunk of subject matter, then it pushes me into new areas and new interesting, or I hope interesting, places with the work that I do. So this is definitely getting rambly at this point. It's nearly midnight on Thursday, so I will call a halt to this for now, and then I will answer more of your questions and either put it up on Patreon or put up it as a next solo episode, either next week or later on, depending on what you say. So email me, alicerfraser@gmail.com. That's the place to hit me up. @alliterative on Twitter. Let me know what you think. Let me know what you want more of or less of, or if I'm talking in a really boring way, if there's not enough intonation in my voice, if you can tell that I'm staring at a wall, if I am just losing track of my sentences and this has made absolutely no sense to you, please tell me. I would like that very much. I mean, don't tell me in a mean way. There's enough of that on the internet, but just let me know what you want, and I will see you next week. I've finished my tea. You're having tea with Alice.
Do you know or do you not? This Dolphin mistress we have got. Elsie Thompson, it is her name, and she helps the Dolphins at every frame. Loudy rifle doll, loudy rifle day. On Monday morning when she comes in, she hangs her coat on the highest pin. Turns around for to view her frames, crying, damn you doppers, cry up your ends. Loudy rifle doll, loudy rifle day. And when the boss, he looks round the door, tie our ends up, doppers, he will roar. We'll tie our ends up, we surely do, for Elsie Thompson, but not for you. Loudy rifle doll, loudy rifle day. Oh, Elsie Thompson is going away. Is it tomorrow or yet today? We'll tie our ends up and leave our frames and wait for Elsie to return again. Loudy rifle doll, loudy rifle day.